Welcome to the latest Infinite Global podcast. Today's episode is the first in a series examining how organizations are using thought leadership to build brand awareness. We will also be taking a look at how professional services firms are getting smarter in the way that they create content that engages their audience. Today, we're joined by Lewis Woodward. Lewis is a communications and marketing consultant. He's a former EY partner where he's led the global communications and engagement function. Prior to that, he was the global marketing officer at EY's assurance practice. Thank you for joining us, Lewis.
Morning, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Could you give us a little bit more on your background, what you've been doing in the various corporate marketing and comms leadership roles that you've held? And can you tell us a bit about the thought leadership initiatives that you've been involved in over the years?
Well, going back, I suppose my career actually started in consumer PR, really sort of brand activation. I started off as a quite young account executive working in consumer sports brands. That was a lot of fun, but quickly realized actually doesn't pay the bills as much as I anticipated it. So started to move into more of a corporate environment. And I've then sort of developed a career that spans, I would say, all aspects of brand marketing communications. You know, I've been part of that generation that's grown up through just the emergence of digital and technology and seeing that transform really how marketing communications functions are able to use data in a different way. And then most recently, I've probably focused a little bit more on the communications side, if I'm honest. And I think that's partly because the level I was then operating put me, you could say, sort of in the inner circle of corporate businesses, and you tend to then be really focused on reputation. So less about how marketing acquisition and marketing programs can drive customer value. It was much more about how we can protect brands, build a reputation through really clever, clear, concise communications, both internally and externally. So my career is pretty broad. I've worked in professional services firms, as you mentioned, you know, sort of the prior role that I'm no longer in, but it was a partner role at EY leading the communications and engagement function. And before that, you know, really focused on CMO type positions in technology firms, business services firms. So really a B2B marketer, apart from that very little sort of snippet into B2C PR and communications at the beginning of my career.
It's interesting that you mentioned data quite early on as well, because that's something that I do want to touch on later. But yeah, in terms of the thought leadership, are there any publications that you would point to that have been a big part of what you've been doing over the last few years?
I've been lucky to be involved in lots of different multi-channel thought leadership programs. I'd say some of my particular areas of focus, as I mentioned, within the audit space, there was a lot of shift in the marketplace that I would happen to be working in, driven through a lot of regulatory reform, a lot of media scrutiny, a lot of pressure really on how the big four were known to deal with the audit, which is seen by many different stakeholders to mean and represent many different things. So as a sort of marketing communications person thrust in the middle of such a dynamic marketplace, it's really important actually to come out with a very clear, focused strategy around what content is going to shape the narrative of the firm in all of these different very dynamic settings and to appease very, very different stakeholders. And without going down a rabbit hole of explaining what an audit is, principally think of the audience as, you know, you've got audit committees, the people that are responsible for appointing an audit firm, you've got investors, people who are actually managing the funds that pension firms are protected in against an audit. You've actually got a firm who's being audited, but you've also got regulators and you've also got people within the business, employees. So actually, if you were to map audiences out, it's very complex. So you need to come out with a narrative that is distinctive to the competition, which anybody listening to this in a marketplace which is potentially quite monopolized, it's very difficult to stand out. You know, the big four is just one example of that. And actually, content is what really makes the difference, I think, and brand of how you can differentiate. You've also then got to make sure your narrative is playing to the and appeasing the different needs of those audience groups. So at my time, we developed some, I would say, pretty provocative and distinctive campaigns that fundamentally were using a marketeer's mindset. So is this data-driven? Is this creative in its way it's engaging? Is it multi-channel? Is it distinctive from the competition? But yet it was also very corporate and potentially quite traditional in the aspect of, is it technically accurate? Does it portray the feeling that the firm is in control of its own destiny and it is a thought leader in the truest sense, not a follower of what other firms are doing. So we did all sorts of different things, some of them very technical, some of them actually rather creative. We also did some quite unusual things, even for an audit firm to be advertising at Heathrow Airport and Frankfurt Airport and New York Airport with a multi-channel program on digital campaign sites. and a lot of internal activity with events. Quite unusual things, I think, potentially what people would expect a big traditional, inverted commas, audit firm to be doing. But actually, that's very much what the audience expects of a firm. And I suppose my observation of working in, you could say, quite a traditional setting, is actually the appetite to be very forward-thinking and very consumer-like, actually, in how you package content together. And I think one of the things that helped us in that sense was just people inside the business and clients I've worked with, both very senior leaders, global chairman, CEO level people, as well as very focused pursuits and salespeople. You know, they're coming often to the marketing communications team saying, you know, we really need our brand to communicate a message in a way we're consuming our own content in the marketplace, which is actually very different to the way corporate communication teams have developed content in the past. So I think that also created an opportunity to be very different and a lot more creative in the way you package communications together.
We work within the accountancy space as well, so we have clients where we will create thought leadership for them. One of the things we've realized is that whilst the external communications and activating those campaigns is really important, actually half the battle is also the internal communication and making sure that the organization is actually buying in and using that thought leadership to the best of their ability. And we find that there's tends to be a lot of waste where a lot of work goes into these thought leadership campaigns, but then no one actually does anything with it.
Well, I mean, absolutely. And I've observed that, you know, of my own campaigns, I'm afraid to say. And I think, you know, leaders, you know, of communication marketing functions need to do the hard yards internally first, which is getting that very strong consensus and alignment with the business. And ultimately, look, if we're creating content that is not supported in any way by a business sales engine or doesn't meet a business objective, then quite frankly, what is the point? It might well look great on paper. It might be the greatest expression of the creative brand you've ever developed. But if there's no follow-up there, then it's going to fall before it's even started. So getting those hard yards done internally is absolutely critical. And so we spoke a lot about, over my sort of career, about the sort of the inside-out strategy. And nothing goes outside of an organization before it's completely embedded and immersed inside the organization. And a former colleague of mine, I won't name check him, but if he hears this, he'll know who he is, always talked about the brand is what a brand does. And in that sense, actually, the biggest brand asset any organization has got, regardless of what your external marketing budget may look like in dollar terms, is its people. And if you can inform and inspire people to be in the marketplace talking about the very latest trends and insights in a provocative, thought-provoking way that's distinctive to the competition, you're absolutely on a winner. And sort of we used to calculate that would probably drive around 70% of your brand awareness. So the rest of the stuff that the marketing and communication team does on top of that fills the gap, the extra remaining 30%. But without that solid foundation of real strong alignment in the business, making sure that whatever you're creating is directly linked to a strategic objective that other people are worried about at night, forget about it. So you've really got to do those hard yards before you even, you know, press launch or even go to the brief stage of anything.
The importance of internal advocacy, that 70% number is really interesting. If you're thinking about thought leadership just from a business development point of view, what you're saying is if you don't get it right internally, you are missing out on all of those opportunities.
Well, I think, yes, you are, but you also think about the downside of not being aligned. You could potentially have a business development function or a client-facing function in some of the firms would call it differently, but they're off having different conversations that's not aligned to what the communications function believe the narrative of that organization should look like at a time. It's creating fragmentation, it's disruptive, gaps appear, and it does demonstrate that there's this sort of conflict internally. Conflict internally is a good thing because it should flesh out, you know, what's really important. But I've also seen it do the opposite, where actually a blind eye is turned and you end up just competing and cannibalizing against your own team to deliver a message to the marketplace. And that's not helpful for any organization. So absolutely the key is to try and get that, as you rightly called it, internal advocacy, which isn't easy in a professional service capacity because it does require a lot of consultation, a lot of agreement. And if you're trying to do things on a global base level, it's even more challenging because then you've got local market challenges and you've got people who are in different territories see the answer to a problem in a slightly different way. And therein lies probably another conversation, which is how do you create content that is flexible at a country level, that can adapt to differing trends, but fundamentally has the same sort of foundation. So certainly if a customer was to pick something up from, you know, my time at EY, I'd like to think that regardless of where they were in the world, they think there was some familiarity and similarity, not only to how it's packaged, how it looks, how it comes across, but there are also strong customization around very relevant topics to that local market. And some organizations, quite frankly, do that better than others, and it's not easy. And you do need a pretty well-oiled machine internally to make that work, but you also need that real strong internal advocacy.
Yeah, and I guess part of that also comes down to branding, right? It has to look and feel a certain way and needs to be universal across territories, across service lines, just to make sure, again, that all the pieces are in the right place and that you're not almost competing with different parts of the business.
Yeah, absolutely. Nobody wants their brand to be unnecessarily fragmented or misunderstood from one marketplace to the other. But it's really difficult, particularly if you've come from that place.
Yeah.
And arguably, you know, professional services firms, certainly, you know, my experience with the Big Four, are still getting there. And some, quite frankly, are better at it than others. But I think, you know, there has been a huge step forward in probably the last decade, really, of how global organizations recognize the world is pretty small. And just because you may today be talking to a customer in the UK, actually their broader customer base, their broader affiliates could be in different territories around the world, Brazil, Mexico, the US. So if you're showing up in a different way in those markets, talking about a topic but with a completely different slant on it, you know, I think it actually presents quite a confused picture of your overall business.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there any thought leadership publications within the professional services world that stand out to you? My previous role, I was head of content at Knight Frank and worked quite a lot on their wealth report,
yeah,
which has become the go-to publication for the ultra high net worth individual population.
Mm-hmm.
So I cite that a lot as something that has had enduring benefit and added value to the brand.
Yeah.
Can you think of any others? They don't necessarily have to be ones that you've worked on. They don't have to be print. They can be, you know, any particular type of media.
Yeah, look, I mean, if you dug into this, there's probably a long list, and firms produce arguably too many different versions of thought leadership, and that's part of the problem. No one necessarily knows what one firm does over the other. I suppose the one that would spring to my mind, and maybe the people listening to this would also have gone there, is McKinsey Quarterly. And we need to just reflect on what they've achieved, really, in that. McKinsey Quarterly arguably is a brand into itself. You know, people think about that as a beacon in the world of content creation and knowledge and insight. And I think McKinsey Quarterly really, you know, set the benchmark for many years around how firms can use content, really, really strong subject matter expertise, thought-provoking points of view, to carve out a narrative in the marketplace. And that is, I think, so far-reaching. It's not just limited to one marketplace. I think that has had global relevance. And to this day, people are still subscribed to McKinsey Quarterly, following having set that subscription up, you know, many, many, many years ago. How many versions of that can you think of that an organization's come out with something, probably the first to do it, but have kept that feeling fresh and probably true to its core value, which is just the quality of the insight. You're not going to get that level of in-depth analysis of a particular sector or issue packaged in a thoughtful way that's consistent in its delivery, that's consistent in its brand over that period of time. So I think firms have come and gone with their own version of that, whether it's a specific survey or report. But, you know, I do think we need to acknowledge, you know, the fantastic work McKinsey have done with that. But I think people, like anything, look at that and think, well, how can I better it? And, you know, arguably, firms have realized that today's expectation of content needs to go beyond the, and I'm again, inverted commas, traditional newsletter, which is a little bit more where the McKinsey Quarterly started. Clearly, it's iterated over time and become much more digitally focused. So lots more different content around things like this, audio, podcast, video content, of course, creations, animations, anytime on-demand access, massive archive, direct sort of live conversations with authors of that content. That creates a lot of effort on behalf of the business. You know, you're not charging people for that. This is free content, but it creates such strong brand advocacy. I would say, you know, they were probably the pioneers and leaders of that and want to sort of acknowledge.
It's funny, when you're creating this sort of thought leadership content, and as you said before, that's free, right?
So
they're putting something into the market there, but at the same time, there has to be this commercial awareness that
you
need to make this, not necessarily pay for itself in an obvious way, but there is a line between producing the purest thought leadership for the sake of it. And I do see a lot of organizations and a lot of research functions that I've worked with in the past, who the research team are purists, and they want this thought leadership out there because they want to create something and give it to the world. But at the same time, there has to be a marketing aspect, and you have to be able to lace some call to action in there and to bring it back to, because at the end of the day, I'll take real estate again. When I was working with the research team of Knight Frank, they weren't creating research for the sake of it. At the end of the day, they were still an estate agency and they still had a product to sell and they were still trying to generate leads. So there's a balance there in the thought leadership. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, when you develop a content plan, you have to ring fence that to be in areas that are either going to broaden your brand consideration. So you may be known for one particular thing. Again, let's use the example that I know best, which is EY, which is arguably known mostly as an audit firm. But actually, there is so much more to that firm than audit. So thought leadership didn't really talk about audit. Talked about all the surprising things that nobody thought EY did. So suddenly you're having conversations about digital services that we're providing for well-known household brands, or what we're doing in the world of maritime and shipping, how we're helping solve some of the world's biggest health issues. So these are all quite surprising things that people didn't know that can be delivered and expressed in a really engaging way in thought leadership. So in that respect, the objective is to broaden the consideration of the brand. And obviously what you're trying to do is appeal to prospective buyers of those sorts of services. If you're in an organization that, as you put it, is creating content which is very genuine, thoughtful and interesting, but really isn't anywhere linked to your organization, then clearly that is going to be a bit of a gap in my mind to get that signed off and question what's the follow through. And I think, you know, that's where organizations have started to recognize there has to be, as you put it, some sort of commercial payback for the investment. So the McKinsey example, yes, it's free content, but there's a value exchange that goes on, and implied in that exchange is, you know, the receipt of data. So you get a subscriber base. Now, they'd be far smarter than me in tracking their own journey of subscribers of McKinsey content and how many of those become potential customers. Again, at EY, that was certainly a focus to try to make the investment in content pay in prospective opportunities, or even to strengthen relationships with existing customers that over time you can really start to measure. And as a function, as a communications marketing function, like any function, we've got to get better at demonstrating value to the boardroom, to fight for retention of budgets, and if not an increase in budget, but also to make our job of making choices better. Because if you're not really measuring stuff to that level of degree, how do you really know what you should be dialing up and what you should be dialing down? And I think, you know, the technology that's now available through really effective CRM platforms and end-to-end sort of analytics available through digital strategies makes that measurement concept as powerful now as it ever has been. And so, you know, if nobody is really attaching a really clear measurement metric around any of this, then they need to.
Do you think there's a particular formula for good thought leadership? You'll talk to some people and they'll say it should be anchored by research and data. Can it be purely anecdotal and opinion-based? In the past, I've seen a lot of, I would say, mixtures of the two, and I've seen both extremes as well.
I mean, the answer is there's no magic formula, but there are things that, you know, work better than others, I would say. As you were asking that question, I just jotted down a couple of words. So one was authentic. To me, thought leadership has got to be authentic to that business. So whatever you do, whatever you sell, whatever marketplace you're in, that's given you a license to some degree to speak on that subject matter. So make that authentic about you as an organization. I think the risk sometimes is people see really big, interesting trends or events happening in a slightly different sector. And I get it. They want to have an opinion and a point of view on that, but it's too quick to sort of jump into something. They don't really have any authentic truth to be in that debate around. So I would always focus on being authentic to what you deliver and what you know and go from there. I think a couple of other things, distinctivity is really important. So there are thousands of pieces of content that are published from each organization every year, arguably too much for any one consumer or audience to engage with and read. So the risk of that is this just becomes complete noise. And in order to stand out from your own messaging as well as the competition in whatever market you're at, you've got to be distinctive. And distinctivity can take the shape in obviously obvious things like the way it's packaged and the creativity around it. But I think some really basic things around tone of voice, whether you're using actual people within the organization to deliver that content, whether you're doing, you know, really thoughtful and intelligent partnerships and alliances with other people in the industry that are potentially on a platform already. And I think distinctivity to me is also just how you're showing up then. And I mean that both in the physical sense of the brand, but also how's that following up with your organization. So that integrated approach to marketing communications is really important. I think also becoming really two-way. The old sort of thought leadership was very one-way. An organization will go away, coordinate with a research guy or a subject matter expert, create some content. Let's hope in time that's become more than just a piece of PDF download. Create that content, push it out. Great, move on to the next one. But where's the debate? Where's the conversation? Where's the interaction with audiences? And I think obviously social media has opened up that opportunity, LinkedIn and Twitter being the obvious areas where you go on now and you see live debates and conversations between current clients, current employees, past employees, prospective clients, third-party vendors, alliance partners. So suddenly the world that you operate in, if you have the confidence to go out there in the social media capacity, can engage with your brand. And I think that is where you really start to drive deep relationships and value.
You preempted one of my questions there, which is...
I haven't seen these in advance, by the
way. One of the things that we will ask our clients beforehand is, we'll say, let's try and find out what the questions are that your audiences are asking at the moment. How can we answer those questions in a way that demonstrates value of the brand? And so it goes back to what you said earlier, which is data. There is so much data available now, and there are so many tools to be listening to what your audiences are saying, that you can have this two-way conversation with them. So it's no longer about, oh, a head of research decides we're putting this out and maybe we're putting it on a PDF somewhere and hiding it on the website. All of a sudden now, you know what they're asking and you can have a back and forth and you can create and you can tailor the content that you're making specifically for the audience and sub-audiences as well, sub-sectors of those audiences, depending on how your business operates, what the service lines are. So the importance of data, I think, is vital. And certainly we've seen more and more organizations who are doing thought leadership well are looking to data. Is that something that EY, I would imagine, was a big focus for you?
Sure. And we didn't always get it right. I mean, you know, this is the holy grail, right, where you can identify and very clearly segment your audience and you can align with that audience a very compelling piece of content proposition that can then be measured through a lifecycle journey, which can ultimately be then converted into an opportunity. I mean, that's really what it all boils down to. But getting there is difficult. But as you say, the proliferation of data platforms has made that a lot more simple. Actually, what my experience has been, our own data has been worse than market data. And, you know, we talked about that collaboration, you could say, between the communications and marketing function and the sales function. And, you know, often I would find out that the marketing function were actually delivering value in generating interest through responses or subscription forms or people dialing into webinars or attending a physical event, whatever the call to action was around a piece of content. But yet that data then suddenly didn't go anywhere. And what that needs then is some sort of data management system inside the business that can be nurtured and go through that appropriate funnel to convert into an opportunity. And therein lies the question around how linked are you with your commercial operation within the organization? And for whatever reason, I've always seen there to be healthy conflict, but conflict. And maybe just it's a lack of real understanding and clarity between what the marketing communications function can do and what the sales function should be doing as new leads, you could call them, are generated. It seems to be a bit of a dark patch in my experience. And
it's so new, right? These worlds were never as close as they are now.
Yeah, and I think part of it is the protectiveness that salespeople feel over their data. And, well, where does this data, if you're presenting somebody with data, they want to sort of clarify that. Well, where does it come from? Why should I go and call this person? And I've got my own set of data. I've got my own clients. I've got my own prospect clients. So, you know, I actually think it sounds really basic, but it's been really hard to mobilize at scale a global communications function, a global business development function. I'm not talking specifically at EY. I think this is a general comment around industry, but it's a really important one. And back to the specifics of data, you can go and acquire data, you can buy that data, you can develop that data organically yourself, but data is only a representation in time. If you're not keeping that data up to date, you're not cleansing that data, and you're not, you know, you're not using that data to build deeper relationships with whoever's on the end of it, again, how valuable is it really? So proper sort of data management requires time, it requires expertise, and it requires constant management around the quality of that. Even internally, you know, just to shift the conversation slightly away from clients and prospects, just communicating to your own employees. You know, large organizations really struggle with that. I know lots of organizations that have hundreds of thousands of employees. They can't send a communication out en masse to those people. You know, they don't really know who's doing what. They don't really know how many people in this geography or this part of the business will get this communication. You sort of think, but we have that data, surely. I mean, their employees. That must be on a database somewhere, right? And yes, but those databases aren't necessarily integrated. They don't talk to each other. And my experience has often been the more global you are, the more difficult that challenge becomes. Yet it becomes even more compelling to do it because you want to be seen as this sort of one firm and you want the global chairman and CEO to reach everybody. But it's not always easy as people think, even when the data is there.
I'm going to slightly segue from thought leadership for a second because you mentioned something that I find interesting, and it was that not necessarily the conflict, but there is a slight disconnect sometimes between the BD sales function and the comms team. And one example I would always cite is, you know, head of social media, for instance. So head of social media or the person responsible for the social media function who may well be engaging in paid social campaigns. Now, is that communications or is that business development? Because ultimately that work is responsible for generating leads. And so I think a lot of organizations struggle to know where to put that person and where that function lies.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, it works in different ways for different companies. So again, there isn't really one sort of overall blueprint that you should follow. I suppose my opinion on that is social media to me feels much more within the realms of communication functions than a BD one, because yes, it could be there to create interest in leads, but that is a generation of a conversation. I think once an audience has been tracked and measured following social media feeds or engaging with that, it should be transferred across into some sort of funnel or pipeline management tool that a business development executive or team can then start to engage with from a commercial capacity. But you know, you've got to be really thoughtful about at what point you do convert that over, because you don't want to preempt anything. You don't potentially want to damage the emergence of a relationship with somebody online. But also, social media isn't just about creating new conversations. It's about managing risk. It's about managing crisis. Yep. It's about, you know, strengthening communications with your existing client base. And in that respect, I've always found it most useful when it's very connected to the broader communication strategy than a sales one.
Are there any trends that you're noticing at the moment in terms of thought leadership, how it's conceived and how it's delivered? So you talked about multi-channel.
Yeah.
And that's certainly something that we see at the moment. Is that factor of a big report still works? But more and more we're seeing people who are including, as you said, podcasts, you know, short videos. We're also seeing a kind of a move towards agile thought leadership, where the amount of work and the amount of data that has informed the content is still there. But at the same time, it's a lot quicker, it's a lot more fleet of foot. And that may be because we're in politically charged times where the news agenda is changing so quickly that actually evergreen thought leadership is more difficult to get hold of. I'm not 100% sure what's driving it, but we do see more of that. So I just wondered if there's anything in particular that you've seen.
Yeah. I suppose the obvious one is mobile, right? Yeah. So I would say you've got to look at the propensity for audiences to consume content. And quite frankly, the time people have to engage with your content from your brand is diminishing by the second. So the time when people were able to pick up a piece of paper or, you know, a downloaded multi-page, exceptionally well-written PDF report and read that are gone. I mean, people may just read the subject line and make a decision as to whether it's for them or not, regardless of who'd written it, how detailed it is. Brands are really fighting for airtime with audiences, and that has shifted how organizations think about content. And mobile is obviously more than just making something bite-sized. It is about making something more engaging that can be consumed on the move. So I actually think the communicators have gotten better at being briefer and more succinct. And that's good, because our audience are not going to give us the time that they used to consume the content. Because guess what? They're not only receiving that content from you. So, you know, they'll be making a choice based on a very few seconds of that piece of content coming in front of them, whether that happens to be through a search engine, an online platform, a digital communication piece on social media, or even an out-of-home advertisement. You know, you're talking about seconds where you're trying to engage with somebody. So I think people are having to be much smarter and much bolder and more distinctive and provocative with communications. And I think arguably what that's done is actually improve the quality, because if you really want to go and read the War and Peace version on a particular issue that's going on in a sector, you're so interested in that, you're going to do your own research. Typically, what you're trying to do is catch a passive audience member on the move from their morning commute into the office or flying somewhere to a business meeting or whatever it may be, and you're interrupting that time. And to interrupt that time, your communication's clearly got to stand out, and it's got to work much harder. So back to the point around Are you speaking to the right audience? Is it authentic? Is it distinctive? And is it engaging in the way that content's being created? And you know, what's great about things like that you're doing with the podcast, you know, this could be a written interview. Probably a few years ago it may have been.
Well, it will be as well.
It will be as well. Well, this is the thing. And so actually you still need to provide audiences with the choice. And I think you've made a good point. Maybe the shift to becoming more agile and digital, brands have actually moved away from giving consumers a choice of how they want to receive the content. And again, brands do this really well, where you know you're interested in something, they'll allow you to make the selection of how you want to be engaged with them. And I think that puts the control into the audience's hand versus the brand's hand, which is, again, a really interesting sort of shift in, we've seen have gone really far forward with digital and mobile, but actually some of the most compelling pieces of communication I've seen in the past few years, and you mentioned the thud factor, which is a great term, not heard for a while, but actually being quite traditional in writing letters, sending something through the mail, stands out. And it doesn't work in every occasion, and clearly it's way more expensive, arguably harder to measure, but to the right audience in the right arena, it's probably the most powerful way of reaching somebody, because it is distinctive, it is unique, and it's highly engaging. So, you know, you've really got to be very thoughtful about what multi-channel means, and I think you've got to be giving your audience respect and giving them the control of deciding how they want to be engaged with your brand.
Yeah, I think this shift is also a consequence of the way the internet has empowered everyday people to become content creators themselves. So
yeah.
If you have an internet connection, you can reach the same audience as EY if you are saying the right things and you are smart about the content that you're creating, for example. And in the past, I think a lot of big organizations were the only game in town. So they were the only people putting any time and effort into this thought leadership. Whereas now, for any sector, there can be an expert who just sits there and creates the content. And so that means that everyone has to step up a little bit and has to diversify their content mix, has to think much harder about the audience that they're talking to and how they're speaking to them. I think it will only benefit the kind of thought leadership that is created in the long run.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, a few sort of thoughts as you're speaking going to my mind, you know, I would be sitting there in that context thinking, well, do I really need to put the time and effort into this particular topic? And arguably, a lot of time we're driven by what, you know, the business feel is the right thing to do on any one time. And, you know, hopefully they're right, but they're not always right. So the communication function needs to have the strength to lead the business. You know, you're there to represent really the audience, and you've got the data. You know what's going to, you know, land. And, you know, you're often being led by a very ambitious, potentially sales organization that I've had a couple of conversations on a topic and want this to be the main theme for the year. But is that really the right thing to do? And I think if you go down a route of being, again, really truthful to your audience, knowing exactly what they want to do, you'll develop content that really cuts through. But you're right, anybody can sort of reach that audience. The pressure then is on the communications function to deliver just really intelligent, quality content. You can't afford mistakes, both in terms of obviously how something shows up, but you can't afford to get things wrong, because just people won't read it. And obviously that's the biggest failure of any piece of communication, if no one picks it up right. If it doesn't hit the mark,
What
have you, you've wasted time. And there are a million things that we could all be doing every day. So really think about, we've got choices, what's the best choice? And the strategy should be defined probably more on what you don't do than what you do. Which is obviously a sort of a harder thing to agree on. We're not going to do these things because we've decided these things are really going to elevate our brand.
And pick, choose your battles.
Correct.
We've talked about actually the creation of thought leadership, but how important is properly activating that thought leadership? So we spoke about internal activation and we spoke briefly about social media.
Yeah.
But more and more, creating amazing thought leadership means nothing if it's not being communicated to the right audiences.
Yeah.
And social media is a big part of that, but it's not the only part of activating thought leadership.
No. So I guess some thoughts on that are, people listening to this may find this familiar, but you create a piece of content and then you'd say, right, let's get that out on social media. And that may be through the Twitter handle of the organization or, you know, the spokesperson on LinkedIn, putting a link out to that piece of communication. Right, that's social done. And obviously the people who are going to see that, based on whatever algorithm at the time is in place, but that social media platform, are mostly going to be, you know, avid followers of that campaign. But that's not really going to, you know, set the world alight with that piece of content. So social means paid. You've got to put money behind the promotion. You're not going to reach at scale the audiences you want just by uploading something to your company or business corporate account page or Twitter handle. So I actually think communications teams need to be given bigger budgets, because often, you know, we're working with really flat budgets and sometimes they've been decreasing year on year. And so we've really got to justify the fact that paying the time and the money to create the content is part of it. What is the activation budget around it? And the activation budget obviously should be either in line with, if not greater than, the cost of the material, because producing this sort of stuff nowadays is relatively cost neutral. So you've got to fight for every dollar you can get to get the activation going out across social platforms, across digital platforms. And obviously, there's the housekeeping stuff around your website, making sure all of your sort of obvious audience touch points are coordinated and consistent with that piece of content. So that's part of it, getting the right activation budget. And it, to me, then it goes back to the question we discussed earlier on, which is the alignment internally. And activation of content is where things fall down. And again, my experience, not only at EY, but other firms I've been in as well, is all about how do you activate the content inside the business before you've hit the go button on external. And that can be really difficult. It can be really difficult because people's time, the matrix of the organization, people have different views. And look, sometimes people are pretty precious about where things come from. And certainly if you're receiving some content from somebody else in the firm or business and it hasn't come from you or your team, often there's a reluctance to take that. And that needs to, that's culture, that needs to change. You know, we're in the business of creating something once, not multiple times, to drive economies of scale. But it's only going to work if everybody gets behind it. So don't underestimate the internal sales job and marketing job on every piece of communication that's required before you go to market. And equally, don't underestimate the money required to really make an impact. Now, obviously, depending on the size of your industry, the budgets will differ. But I'd be really shocked if people are getting the sort of impact they want without putting any investment into activation.
You see a lot of thought leadership publications who maybe launch once a year and they'll go live and there'll be a lot of PR activity around the launch.
Yeah.
And maybe the campaign lasts a month. And then internally there'll be a wash up and people will say, all right, fine, give me the social numbers. What are the press cuttings? But ultimately that publication, that thought leadership is often wasted and the graph goes up in terms of activity and then it drops back down again. I think a few organizations now are looking at these resources and are actually trying to make it a sort of annual, year-long resource. And part of that, I think, is in the way that they activate it, is drip feeding that content so that it's going throughout the year and those audiences are engaging the whole time. You're getting more bang for your buck and you're already sweating the asset. But at the same time, the thought leadership has to have the right balance of timely in terms of the news agenda, but then also having the right amount of evergreen content that will last the year. So just wondered what you thought about that in terms of activation and the timings.
I mean, I think that's really, the way you've described it, I think that's really hard to manage in the context of having one piece of thought leadership and drip feeding that, particularly over the period of a year. A year is just too long. Mm. Too much can change, people change, issues change, you know, governments change. And as you say, the geopolitical and business environment that we're seeing now, things are moving on a dime. So week by week, arguably day by day, over the last several months in the UK at least, you know, you never really know what's going to be topical tomorrow. So how can you develop a content plan that's drip feeding content over a year? I'd say that's actually becoming nowadays very difficult to do. I think you can do it in a slightly different way, which is agree on a cluster of themes. And maybe it's not one content agenda. It's a cluster of different macro issues that allow you at any one time to dip in and out of the conversation. But even then, I think, you know, you've really got to be strong in whatever your drip feed communication looks like to be impactful, cut through, distinctive. And have you got something interesting to say? And I think people nowadays are smarter than ever. And you know, audiences understand the techniques used by firms in a thought leadership capacity to try and engage with them. So we're now dealing with a really savvy, well-educated, informed audience base. And they see through you. So it is really difficult to get this right. I would say you've got to be prepared for both. You've got to have a well-developed, proactive plan. I would say that needs to be clustered around three or four, no more than that, key issues. And maybe you could look at that on a bi-monthly basis. But you also need a reactive engine. You've got to have capacity to develop on-the-fly content that is delivered to the same quality standards as something that you've spent weeks and months planning and developing. And you've got to be able to get that out to your audiences through your owned channels and paid channels overnight. So that in a planning capacity causes a bit of difficulty because you're planning for something that you don't know has happened yet. So on your sort of budget line in your communication plan, it's AOB, for want of a better term. But you need to keep capacity of resource, spend, and also you need to free up airtime in your communication narrative to allow for those reactive communications. And let's face it, most organizations over the last probably 18 months to 2 years have been having to react to huge disruptive forces to their either specific industry or their geography or obviously their geopolitical environment, particularly if you're in a thought leadership and a professional services capacity. So you know, how are you making allowances for that while simultaneously delivering a narrative which is furthering your own brand's business objectives? And that's the dichotomy, I think, for most communications functions at the moment.
It's funny you mentioned that audiences are becoming more savvy to this sort of thing, especially in terms of ways of trying to create thought leadership that you can drip through across the year. When I was still a journalist, I was a financial journalist, and we used to get sent a lot of indices all the time. And at that point, it was just after the credit crunch. So any house price index, we would cover it, we would do something with it. And then a few years later, when I moved into public relations and we were sending out our own indices, I remember journalists saying to me, "Oh, not another index." Because the index wasn't actually saying anything different than it said the previous quarter or the quarter before that. But a lot of these brands had become a bit complacent because they knew if they created this data and they sent it out, they would get a reaction.
Yeah.
Whereas now, that doesn't really cut it unless it's saying something different, unless it's something that's properly engaged with the newsender at that time.
Correct.
Then people will ignore it.
Yeah, I think the whole index indices research route thought leadership has a role. Arguably, it's becoming less important because the proliferation of different versions of them and real-time data available on that issue all year round is so strong. So you've really got to think through how does that one piece of research stand tall above the rest. But I think some of that comes to, is it authentic to that business? And an e-wider version of that in the form of Capital Confidence Barometer, which was an annual survey of the M&A market. And that was really used as the sort of de facto view of merger and acquisition that's going on at any one time. There was also a fraud survey that was known in the marketplace for the same thing. But, you know, in the future, will they have the same clout of moment in time? It's going to be a real challenge. So you've got to then stretch the value of just what the data says and wrap a lot more insight and thought leadership around it. So what becomes more engaging isn't the index itself, isn't the list of who's buying who and who's acquiring who. It's what's the subplot behind that? What's the predictive insight that could help inform people of the next 6 months to give people that competitive edge in their marketplace? And that's where I think then communicators become much more commercial in the way they develop content, and it forces communicators to have really strong relationships with the business. So it's not just about running it and packaging it and pushing it out. It's about going to that level of detail which starts to tease out the subplot of that piece of research that can then be packaged in a really engaging, inspiring way. And I think, you know, your term of sort of squeezing the lemon on all of this stuff is absolutely right. You've got to think through how can this piece of content work really hard. But I do question how, you know, the days of having just one big killer piece of research running on an annual basis, just purely it's going to be very difficult for that to survive amidst all the proliferation of data available on pretty much every issue.
Yeah. Lastly, we've seen a few organizations who've started to wade into politics and within their thought leadership, and others are, you know, wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. Given the current political climate, there are more opportunities to be involved in this sort of commentary. And I wondered what your thoughts were in terms of, is there value in doing this, or is it less risky and just worth not touching it at all?
No, it is risky. I mean, I don't think you could say it isn't risky. If you're engaging on a political debate, and if you're doing that properly, you've got to be provocative and thought-provoking, or else no one's going to read it. You know, you don't want your brand to turn into a news broadcaster where you're just disseminating information that's already available. I think that is the worst thing organizations can do. But it's often what I see organizations do because it's sort of a halfway house. Let's take an issue that we're all very familiar with, the B word. So every organization, should they have a view on Brexit? Should they have a communication agenda around that? And I think once people start to think they should and they get into it, they quickly become in that horrible place of just trying to disseminate information that's already available. But that's not your role. You're not a news outlet. You're not a broadcaster in that sense. So don't just regurgitate content that's already out there. And if you haven't got anything to add to the debate, don't. Brands obviously are then uncomfortable about coming forward with a very strong view for obvious reasons. I mean, you know, the political environment can be very divisive, not only for clients, but for your own people in the business. And the last thing I think organizations want to do is create tension and culture challenges around a geopolitical debate. But if you can navigate all of that, and if you can, through working with the right people, and maybe those are people outside of your organization, so it's maybe an alliance-based strategy, start to carve out insight on a debate, forward projection on a debate, or even just be a convener of other people that are debating this issue to a degree which is pretty fresh and unique. I think there is value in doing that. But, you know, all around the world, it's very difficult to get that right. And if you're a global organization, there are big pressures right now, not just around, are you pro one political agenda or pro another? I think organizations, are, from a communications point of view, are always having to look at themselves and say, look, there is a populist sort of nationalist trend at the moment. And a lot of the organizations that we've referenced are very global, which is sort of the opposite of what is the trend from a political point of view. So that sort of stands out. How can you be trying to be this global thought leader business when a lot of your audiences potentially are have a nationalist mindset and your clients have a nationalist mindset? There's a lot of stress and scrutiny on capitalism and wealth and success in that regard. So organizations that are extremely large in both headcount but also revenue terms that aren't being really transparent, I think, are really having to think about their reputation. And maybe we see a reduction in the sorts of political debates they used to get involved in, because actually it's safer to be away from that. But also I think it puts pressure on communications function to think about what's their own business value at the moment, as in what's the role they're playing in the world. And I think one area brands could start to explore is talking about their underlying purpose in the world as it stands today, and not get drawn in too much on local, domestic, regulatory or political events. More focus on what's compelling about your organization during this backdrop and your sort of long-term value or your purpose as an organization. And that, I mean, then is back to being authentic and distinctive and probably a bit of a safer area to play.
Thank you for coming in to speak to us today, Lewis. It's been a real pleasure and really interesting to hear your take on thought leadership and the way things are changing and best practice. So thank you.
Pleasure, Jamie. Good to see you. Hope people enjoyed listening to it.
That's it from this edition of the Infinite Global Podcast. Keep an eye on our LinkedIn and Twitter channels for the next edition.